From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. In 1989, environmental activist Bill McKibben wrote a bestseller called The End of Nature. It painted an apocalyptic picture of the state of the planet. Nearly three decades later, we take a look at a book of essays by the generation that grew up after McKibben had laid out his vision.
They're the first generation that learned the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle from Sesame Street. First generation to see really tangible evidence of changes in the environment, from garbage islands floating to ice caps melting.
That's the co-editor of Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. We also hear from two young writers who contributed essays to the book. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In 1989, the now famous environmental activist Bill McKibben published his first book called The End of Nature. It was an exploration of the idea that pristine nature, untouched by humankind, no longer existed. It was also one of the first books to tackle climate change. Nearly 30 years later, an homage of sorts has been published. It's titled Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. In this new book, 22 young writers, millennials, most born after McKibben wrote his manifesto, take on what it has been like to grow up in the aftermath of the end of nature. Later in the show, we'll hear from two of those young authors. But first, the book's co-editor joins us. Susan Cohen is a professor of English and coordinator of creative writing at Anne Arundel Community College, and she's here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much for having me here.
I'm glad you could come. How did this book come about?
So it begins with my co-editor, Julie Dunlap. She had an idea. She had just finished doing an anthology called Companions in Wonder, where I had an essay included. And she wanted to hear the voices of the millennials coming up. And she and I have worked on projects together before. And so we thought we'd collaborate. We started off thinking, what does this group of young people who are born and come of age after Bill McKibben's book comes out, what do they have to say?
Climate change may be relatively new, but human beings have been altering the planet for as long as we've been living on it. We've been causing extinctions for thousands of years, for example. What makes this moment different?
Well, we're reaching a tipping point. And I will say that this particular generation is important to pay attention to. They're the first generation that has environmental education from the time that they're in nursery school till they get through all their public education or private education. They're the first generation that learned the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle from Sesame Street. They are the first generation to see really tangible evidence of changes in the environment, from garbage islands floating to ice caps melting to oil spills killing wildlife. So they never have a moment, unlike my generation, I'm a boomer, where we don't have to have that in our news, in our school program. They're always aware of this dramatic change. And so we thought we should hear from them.
Do you notice a different outlook on nature and environmentalism in your students than among, say, your peers?
So my peers, I'm surrounded with people, most of them who have been paying attention and raising children in this generation. But we grew up thinking that everything could be fixed, that it could be solved pretty easily. Even with Rachel Carson influence behind us, we thought, well, if we stop the spread of DDT, the environment will recover. But this generation does not see that. So it was seemed important to us to recognize that they have a different experience.
In the book's introduction, you and your co-editor, Julie Dunlap, point to a 2010 study on climate change and young people. And one finding by the researchers was that while young adults are more likely to believe climate change is real, they are less likely than older adults to spend much time thinking about it. What do you make of that?
So we've pondered this a lot, and we've asked people. There are a few things. First of all, there are two groups in that study. The 18 to approximately 22 or 24-year-olds are more active than the 22 to 34-year-olds. And so let's think about the sort of period of life they're in. When you're 24, just out of college, you may not have all that time to engage. You might be having children, as some of our writers. You're looking for jobs. But we're not sure. I would say the answer is we're not sure why the general population of this generation, which believes in climate change, believes that it's there and that it's true, is not necessarily engaged.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Susan Cohen, co-editor of a new anthology of essays about the environment by young writers called Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. How did you home in on these particular 22 writers?
We sent out a call for papers. This is 4 years ago. It's taken us a long time to get this book together. And we had hundreds of submissions. And we worked with writers who had diverse experiences, diverse points of view. We thought they were fine writers, that they were telling strong stories that could relate to all kinds of people, so that the writers weren't just talking about something technological or scientific, but they were incorporating the science and technology into these very credible stories.
Was there something that surprised you in these essays as a group?
I wasn't surprised by the passion of the writers, but I was surprised perhaps about how many of them looked at suburbia, urban places, and talked about those places as both cultured and wild.
Do you think any one conclusion can be drawn from all these essays about how millennials see the natural world?
It's hard to speak for a very large group, but I do think that we can see that this group, at least these writers and the 100 writers or so that aren't published in the book whose work we read, that they care deeply and that they are angry, but they are also hopeful.
What do you think keeps this new generation hopeful, given the failure of our generation to stop climate change?
So when we read the essays of these young writers, I think what keeps them hopeful is that they have more knowledge about the problems and that they feel, at least the ones that are in our book, that they can write about and challenge and work in areas that are directly related to fixing the planet. Whereas our generation might have done that in a volunteer basis, these people are training themselves to make repairs to our planet.
We need to take a short break here, and when we come back on the record, we will, as Susan said, meet two of the young writers who contributed to Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Nearly three decades ago, a book called The End of Nature got wide attention with its assertion that pristine wilderness no longer exists. The influence of man is everywhere. Bill McKibben wrote then, quote, "We might not have ended rainfall or sunlight. In fact, rainfall and sunlight might become more important forces in our lives. But the meaning of the wind, the sun, the rain of nature has already changed," close quote. Now there's a new book, a collection of 22 essays by young writers who grew up after McKibben's manifesto with insights into how that meaning has changed. The new book is Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. It's co-edited with Julie Dunlap by Susan Cohen, a professor of English and coordinator of creative writing at Anne Arundel Community College. She's with me in the studio. And now we're joined by two of the essayists, James Orbison, who is 30, is a writer and adjunct English professor from Chicago. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much.
And Emily Skocid, who is 29, is a poet and a sustainability planner at Virginia Tech University with a master's degree from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
James Orbison, you write about how saturated your childhood was with environmentalism, from school trips to the recycling center to cartoons you watched. You write, "What I think my childhood exposure to environmental awareness did was convince me that the adults were on the job," close quote. What did you mean by that?
As a young kid, kind of being exposed to these units, it would be like, all right, here's our environmental unit. And it would be prepared with all these sort of trappings. There would be videos we'd watch. There was this whole workbook we'd go through. And I figured this was so prepared that this must be something that people were on the case. They're all ready to solve this problem, and we're just supposed to be the youngest acolytes to help solve this problem if maybe it takes more than just one generation, sixth or second generation to do it. The adults get it.
And at some point, you changed your mind about that. Was there a particular moment when you thought, wait a minute, the grown-ups don't really have a handle on this?
At a certain time, I started realizing, like, the workbooks we're having are made of paper. And my essay also talked about going to a restaurant called Rainforest Cafe or watching Captain Planet on Ted Turner's network. There's this sort of, we are invested in environmentalism. After Al Gore released Infinite Truth, there was this big kind of drive, especially like by BP, to rebrand itself as, you know, Beyond Petroleum. But then we had the big oil spill, the Gulf Horizon oil spill. It just seemed like something that was both one foot in this one pool, but still not fully committed to diving in.
Let me pull Emily Skosid into this conversation. Emily, your essay is titled, "Could Mopping, M-O-P-P-I-N-G, Save the World? How Day-to-Day Chores Can Bring Big Changes." It's about your time at a place called the Llama Foundation. What is the Llama Foundation? Where is it?
So the Llama Foundation is a meditation retreat center, educational center. It's in northern New Mexico. So it's in the mountains overlooking the Rio Grande Gorge,
and why
sort of in the middle of nowhere.
Why did you go there?
So when I learned about the Llama Foundation, they called themselves a sustainable spiritual community. And I was also in graduate school. I had to look for an interesting research project for the summer in between my 2 years. And I was starting to get really interested in community building and what does it mean to create a sustainable community. So I was like, well, here's a self-proclaimed one. I'm going to go figure out what they're doing and see what it's like to live in a community that calls themselves sustainable.
How did you picture the place before you went there?
I had all of these ideas of grandeur that every building would be covered in solar panels and there would be high-tech composting toilets and, you know, all of the little gadgets that we hear as like the savior for sustainability, you know. And that's not really what I found.
What did you find?
The Llama Foundation does get their electricity from solar panels, but, you know, mostly what I found was a focus on creating interpersonal relationships and gratitude for one another, gratitude for the resources that we have. They're in the middle of a high desert. There's almost no water. But the conversation was never about how do we get more water. It was how do we appreciate every single drop that we have and make sure that nothing goes to waste because it's so precious and we're so grateful for it.
I really want to underscore the contrast you draw between your expectation that they would be on top of a lot of technology. They heat their water with propane. There are some of the solar panels you saw that weren't hooked up. And the so-called composting toilet turns out to be a hole in the ground.
Yes.
They are much more focused on the human connections of the community living there than on the technology.
Correct.
That troubled you.
At first, it really did. I was coming from, you know, highly academic place where, you know, in graduate school, that's what we talked about. How do you make the differences in these communities? You find the next best technology to implement. You find the next best policy to implement. You do research. And so when I got there, that's kind of what I thought sustainable communities were built on. Yeah, at first I was troubled that that wasn't what was going on. And I was like, how can you call yourself sustainable if you're not, you know, using these things? And what I came to realize was that they were taking just a different approach, that sustainability literally meant able to continue on in perpetuity. And the way they could do that was through caring about this place so much that its failure would be the deepest tragedy that they can imagine.
That's Emily Skosid here on the record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is James Orbison. They are both essayists in the compilation Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. And here with me in the studio is a co-editor of this new book, Susan Cohen. Susan Cohen, tell me what struck you about James's essay.
Well, one of the things that we loved when we read it, when it first came through, was how clear he was about being bamboozled. He writes in his essay, he's bamboozled by the idea that the older generation was going to somehow fix the problems, that they were in charge. But by the end of the essay, he comes to this point of saying, well, I'll still be here, and I am going to be part of the fix, the next group of people that will step in and at least try to make a difference. So he takes responsibility. He seems to have hope. But he's reflecting something that's pretty common in the whole book, is that this generation grows up thinking about maybe we were lied to. And James doesn't say necessarily that he's been lied to, but somehow that the message is not clear. And yet these people in this book, they all seem to turn around and say, okay, we have to do something. And that's what they do, whether it is going into an intentional community like Lama Foundation and trying to figure out what works there, whether it is living in Baltimore and clearing out part of the city to create an urban farm. They try to find ways, even if they're regional, local, or block by block, of what to do to make things better.
James, do you think that you're more conscientious about the effect of your actions on the environment because you have more years ahead of you than older generations, and because you're now tied to a new generation coming up?
Now, I think that that kind of passing the baton from one generation to another, right, I'll pass that on one day to my daughter. Just essay that kind of anger I had. The anger I felt was not just to rant or to complain, but to make into a productive space of where I can make change. It's not just me griping. I can take this and aim it towards a specific goal.
Susan Cohen, what struck you about Emily's essay?
Well, Emily in her essay learns to love the community she's in, and there's a moment that's just beautiful where she is asked to be thankful for the water she's holding in her cup. And she says, I've never thought to say thank you to the water before. I think at that moment, she is more connected to how we appreciate what we have on the earth and then therefore perhaps find the technology or other ways to get the community engaged in making it a healthier planet. So that's just a beautiful moment in her essay. There are many moments like that.
There are. It is a beautiful essay. Emily Skosid, you do raise the question near the end of your essay about what happens when community isn't enough. You've written about how short the supply of water can be in some seasons in New Mexico. And you raise the question, well, what if community isn't really enough? At some point, there just isn't the water.
Exactly. I think that community is sort of the basis that we have to use to begin building our sustainable communities. Interpersonal relationships, gratitude, sense of place, sense of belonging. We really can't go very far until we have that. But at some point, there do need to be more substantive changes. What often gets forgotten is that sort of basis of community and belonging and gratitude and love. When you have those things, you're more willing to make sacrifices, at Llama Foundation, we were allowed to take 2 5-minute showers a week. I feel like a lot of people would be horrified if that was all the shower time they got in a desert in the middle of summer. But because we truly understood that every drop of water is precious, everyone was willing to make that sacrifice.
Are you positing in this beautiful essay that every person on the planet needs to go through this awareness of community, of caring for each other and for the environment, for us to avoid disaster?
I think I am. I really think that we'll be able to save ourselves in a really substantive way if we did take the time to think about what we have and to be grateful for what we have and who we have and where we are.
We are not a call-in show, but I think I hear some listeners saying, good luck with that.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a tall order. But even starting with your neighbors, a lot of people have never met their neighbors. That didn't used to be the case. I think if we can create these places where we really care about each other in a real way, that we'd be more willing to make sure that these places where we live continue to exist.
Susan Cohen, one of your writers, William Thomas, is from Baltimore. He is a founder of the Baltimore Free Farm, is it?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Tell us briefly about his essay.
Before Baltimore Free Farm is functioning, Bill is sort of looking for recycled materials to help build the farm and to establish a home place. They're squatting in an abandoned row house in Baltimore. And he finds himself breaking into an abandoned badge factory in Baltimore. And he drops down into the building and he turns on his flashlight. And what is stunning in this essay, or at least what I love in this essay, is that he turns the light on and he moves through the building and the building erupts with the birds that are inside. And he starts to see this connection between culture and nature. And in this particular case, the building is harboring the birds. And so it's a beautiful image and metaphor for the way things are working, at least in inner city Baltimore. Of course, we understand that he's looking for materials that he's going to take out of that building, but he wants to turn them into an urban farm. And any of your listeners who are familiar with Baltimore Free Farm might know that they had Free Food Wednesdays, that they created plots for people in the community to do some farming. And so, just like Emily, he finds a way to create a community out of a place where there was none, with the other people in the Baltimore Free Farm Collective. So I think a lot of our writers are sort of thinking about community and working together.
Bill Thomas asserts his last sentence, ownership of anything is temporary. The wild will come to take it back. And that's essentially his justification for taking things out of property that he doesn't own.
That's right. Now, most of the time, the collective of Baltimore Free Farm were able to convince people to donate. So it's not that they're always taking things that they should own, but he does justify that because that factory has been sitting there for such a long time. And no one has actually used it. I'm not going to justify that personally, but that's what he writes about.
Susan Cohen is co-editor of the new book, Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet. She's also a professor of English and coordinator of creative writing at Anne Arundel Community College. Her co-editor, Julie Dunlap, teaches environmental science and sustainability at the University of Maryland University College. James Orbison and Emily Skosid each wrote essays in the book. James Orbison is an adjunct English professor from Chicago, and Emily Skosid is a sustainability planner at Virginia Tech University. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
More about the book at the On the Record page at wypr.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you could join us today. Tune in tomorrow.